I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a new faith. It's called the Church of Hopeful Uncertainty. But first, there was a vote last night at 1 a.m. There will be another at 7 a.m. tomorrow. Today, Senate Republicans are having to explain why they're dragging out the test votes on health reform when it's clear Democrats have the votes. Here's Republican John McCain answering that question on Good Morning America.
Because they haven't got the American public. They had 60% of the United States Senate. 60% of the American people are against this.
Meanwhile, Democratic senators, including key player Ben Nelson of Nebraska, who held up the bill for tougher language on abortion, are being asked, why vote for a bill that isn't perfect? His answer, something needs to be done to control health care costs. President Obama echoed that this morning, praising senators for taking action on a bill that he says will reduce the deficit in the long term. Joining us from Washington is Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. Rick, you write for Senate Democrats and President Obama. This is a win with some potential losses, and for Republicans, this is a loss with some potential wins. What do you mean?
Well, Senator McCain is right. If you look at the opinion polls, the public is not on board for what's being done with health care. So the calculation by Republicans is that Democrats are overreaching here. They're content to see that play out as much as possible. Republicans, meanwhile, they see their party pretty united behind this. And Democrats, I think, are optimistic they'll have something to sell next year to the American people, but it's not necessarily something that's going to be overwhelmingly positive.
Well, and it's not something they're going to see that soon, even when all is said and done and enacted. And conservative Democrat Ben Nelson did vote to move the bill forward. A lot of discussion back and forth on this over the weekend. And now he's being criticized by both sides of the aisle. Remind us why.
Well, he got a special deal for his state. It's $100 million per year in Medicaid assistance, just for Nebraskans. This is a special deal that no one else gets. And he also accepted abortion language that is not quite as strong as what that was passed in the House. He seems to have gone back on his word a little bit in that respect, so he's hearing it on that, but he's saying this is a good deal for his state, but the governor of his state is coming out and saying this is not the kind of good deal that we were looking for.
Well, but what finally is the language on abortion in the Senate bill, if you could briefly sum it up?
The Senate bill provides that there could be some insurance plans, even those that participate in the exchange, that offer abortion as one of the coverage options. It wouldn't be something that people would be eligible to buy into through any of the public subsidies, but it would still exist out there. And that's something that's not as strong as the House language, which would ban that entirely.
So the Senate bill requires that every state have at least one insurance service that provides abortions that are not subsidized by federal money?
That's right, and it's a little bit more lax than the House version. Some of the so-called pro-choice folks, the people that support abortion rights, say it already does go too far, but again, it's not as strong as in the House.
But then there are also pro-choice critics of the bill that say that it's going to be very hard to find an insurance company willing to provide abortions if, in fact, it becomes sort of a boutique service. But as you said, on the right, there's a lot of criticism of Ben Nelson because any abortion coverage got through.
That's right. And now they're going to have to work this out with the House. And the House has gone further in the direction of limiting abortion rights. And so Senator Nelson would like to see that adopted. So I think the pro-choice folks are going to be less happy in all likelihood with the final version.
Well, just do take us through, though, this week. Couple more votes if Republicans keep voting no on the test votes.
That's right. Look, the vote early this morning really seals the deal. They've got 60 votes. It's pretty clear. The final passage vote, which right now would be scheduled for Thursday night, Christmas Eve, that you don't even need 60 votes for that. That's just final passage. So right now it's clear the Democrats have the votes. The Republicans are just going through some procedural obstacles right now, making Democrats take as many votes as possible, slowing down as much as possible. No one is under any illusion that the final vote is going to be any different, though.
Well, and just give us a sense of what the mood is in Washington, given that. I mean, these are families that want to get home for Christmas. They're not going to be able to. And yet the Republicans feel, you know, obviously they want to make a statement. So what's the mood there?
Extraordinarily bitter. The Republicans as well as Democrats just feel like enough is enough. Let's be done with this. They're weary. They don't want to see this rammed through. There are a couple of Republicans who really want to round the clock as much as possible. But there's resistance inside the Republican caucus as well. People that say, look, we've lost this round. Let's just go fight it with the American people. There's no reason to keep people here late on Christmas Eve after we already did a couple of all-nighters. These are not young men and women who were casting these votes. They have other things they'd rather be doing than pulling all-nighters around this. And add to that the snowstorm, which sort of paralyzed the city and created a lot of travel woes. Not a lot of happy campers this winter.
Yeah. Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. Rick, happy holidays to you.
Same to you.
Well, Well, we are bearing down on Christmas like a speeding 747. And out on the left wing are the new atheists, like British biologist Richard Dawkins, author of The God Delusion, and journalist Christopher Hitchens. To them, it's not enough to not believe in God or Christmas. They believe in challenging those who do. Out on the far right wing, fundamentalist evangelicals focus on the family's James Dobson or megachurch pastor Rick Warren, who believe theirs is the only God and it's their mission to convert others. And in the middle is Frank Schaefer. You may know Frank as the son of former leading evangelicals Edith and Francis Schaefer, who famously founded a Christian commune in Switzerland in the 1950s and helped shape today's Christian right. Frank was a fundamentalist also until he became a member of what he calls the Church of the Hopeful Uncertainty.
I was invited to preach from Jerry Falwell's pulpit, appeared many times on the 700 Club with Pat Robertson, and met privately with many of the top Republican leadership of the day. In the midst of these heady experiences, I began to change my mind about what I believed, and not just about religion, but about the politics, too. By the mid-1980s, I began the process of escaping my family's literal-minded religion and the political causes that had become indistinguishable from it.
Hence, he joined what he calls the Church of the Hopeful Uncertainty, and he's written widely about that transition and what he thinks is wrong with the Christian right. But in Frank Schaefer's latest book, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, he also takes on the new atheists out there on our left wing. Frank joins us in the studio, and Frank, you say, as this group of new atheists takes on the Christian right, they've become fundamentalists themselves. They've made atheism into a religion?
Well, my argument is not with the philosophy of atheism. My argument is with a culture war that has overtaken the discussion about religion. Look, when dealing with the big questions, does God exist, the meaning of life, nobody has any answers. We're like ants by a freeway looking at the pebble in front of us. And we see a little blurred traffic, and then we try to draw these huge conclusions about the cosmos. What I object to with the new atheists is the fact that they remind me of my mother in the 1950s when she was proselytizing the quote-unquote lost, who might have been liberal Protestants, atheists, Jews who were on their way to hell because they didn't believe in Jesus. And when I read Richard Dawkins, I'm reading my mother, except you take the word Jesus out, and he's trying to save the lost, in this case lost to religion, and give them the true faith, which in his view is a form of atheism. So I'm really just trying to get away from these arguments between people yelling at each other at the top of their voice about what I regard as false certainties.
Well, but Richard Dawkins would say that's not fair. He says he has a loud voice because he has no choice. He and other of the new atheists say, you know, religion has been somehow immunized against criticism, and yet they've stood by and watched as religions cause war, affect public policy, put creationism in schools. They say we have to do this. We have no choice. People have put religion in the public square.
Well, following that logic of hit and hit back again and again and again, then we all have to just keep fighting forever. And I don't see that as the alternative. I think a better discussion to have is what really changes our lives and gives them meaning. And for me, for instance, it's my one-year-old granddaughter, Lucy. It's a relationship with my 95-year-old mother who has fought with me through my whole life over these theological issues, and yet we're great friends and we love each other in spite of the fact we disagree over everything.
How did it change for you? You know, you were a fundamentalist. You followed in your father's footsteps,
right,
helping to shape the Christian right. We read in Max Blumenthal's Republican Gomorrah,
right,
that on your father's deathbed, he very much regretted,
yeah,
what had come in his name. But how about you? I mean, how did you switch? What, you didn't have the deathbed.
Well, two things. First of all, I've always been interested in the arts, and you can't grow up interested in the arts and wind up in a neighborhood where nobody likes art, literature, or people who involve themselves with that, which is what the anti-knowledge, anti-education fundamentalist right has become. But on the spiritual side, it gradually dawned on me that bad news was good news to these guys. They wanted America to fail. It's sort of like a pre-Rush Limbaugh wanting Obama to fail. You know, if America went to hell on a handcart, it would, quote-unquote, prove them right. It would prove that unless this was a Christian country with a theocracy in the wings, that somehow it wouldn't work. And so, you know, when crime goes down in New York City with Giuliani and has nothing to do with everybody believing in Jesus, this is bad news to evangelicals who say that without Jesus, nothing can get done. And so I just felt that I was part of a very negative anti-American movement.
And you also write there's part of the end times thinking. And you happen to be old friends with a lot of these people, including the creators of the End Times series.
Right.
You think they're very nice people, but part of what that thinking is doing is, you know, hoping that there is some sort of apocalyptic end times, which worried you. But in being as critical as you just were, what makes you different from the new atheists that you criticize for being critical of the Christian right?
Nothing when it comes to that. I think my view of the evangelical and Christian right would be identical to that of a lot of the new atheists. The only difference is that I haven't completely turned my back on the genuine spiritual dynamic that people bring to their lives in need. That's simply a matter of the fact that when I hold my little granddaughter Lucy, something passes between us, which is more than just the explanation that, for instance, brain chemistry affords me, and that could be an emotional crutch or it could be real, but I believe in the power of love, I believe in the power of spirituality, and I'm not ready to laugh at or call everybody who does an idiot, which a lot of the new atheists suffer from.
Well, and these are the so-called new atheists, but there are longtime atheists that you would not put in this category, you say, and I'm wondering if one would be scientist E.O. Wilson, who reached out to evangelicals to try to forge common ground on global warming.
Yeah, I think A.O. Wilson's a good example. I think Daniel Dennett is a good example. I think some of the traditional people like Hume, David Hume and Spinoza, Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin had a journey in his own life when he went from being an Anglican Christian to an agnostic and finally to, I believe, you would be able to call him an atheist. But he did not wind up spending his life beating a drum, either mocking or trying to convert religious people to non-faith. He simply just pursued his science and let the chips fall where they may. And conversely, from the Christian side, you have people like the late John Updike, very religious and wrestling with these things, but I don't think he was an idiot, and I don't think he was a fundamentalist. You have devout Christians like Johann Sebastian Bach or the artist Rembrandt, who's painting his famous painting of Dante, his wife holding the bed covers open, inviting him into the bed to have sex with her. This is not what you would find on the 700 Club website. You know, culture and art are also part of the Christian tradition. And so I don't think our choice is between Bill Maher making cracks about imaginary friends or Pat Robertson. You know, I don't have to live in either of those people's world. There's a bigger and much more interesting world out there. Fortunately, most people aren't on the extremes. And I just think I would rather be in that bigger, less certain, kinder, more open world.
That's Frank Schaeffer, author of Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism. And by the way, he just referenced Bill Maher. That's, of course, the left-leaning TV host. His documentary, Religious, mocked organized religion. And Pat Robertson, who hosts the TV talk show, The 700 Club on the Christian Broadcasting Network. He's denounced Islam as satanic, said some Protestant sects harbor ideas of the Antichrist. Well, by the way, Frank, we should say you are now a member of the Greek Orthodox Church, in part because of their history of embracing the arts, but also, you say, their tradition of tolerance. We're going to take a break, and in a minute, we want to hear about what you say neither side in the debate are paying enough attention to. In 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back. We're talking with Frank Schaeffer. His parents, Edith and Francis Schaeffer, were leading Christian fundamentalist missionaries. He was as well until the late 1980s. He's written widely about why he left the Christian right. But in his new book, Patience with God, he also is taking aim at proselytizing atheists. Frank says they are fundamentalists in atheist clothing. And Frank, you prefer an apophatic theology. What is that?
Well, apophatic theology really is just a statement that if there is a God, we can't know anything about him, let alone describe that God. But what we can do is look at the broad strokes of the teachings of not just Christianity, but, for instance, good humanistic philosophy, and that is the golden rule of treat others as you would be treated. And so, essentially, you know, my beef with the fundamentalism of both the atheism and the evangelical fundamentalist group is that neither practice the golden rule. If someone is a believer, there's no point in trying to talk them out of what gives their life meaning as long as they're not harming other people with it, which is a big caveat because sometimes religion is terribly harmful. But then again, sometimes atheism is too. I mean, Joseph Stalin was not a religious leader, nor was Pol Pot, nor was Mao Zedong. So we can trade these insults forever. I think there's a better discussion, and that is, what does it mean to be a human being? And this is where everybody with grand theories should just back off the big questions and get to the real questions about our relationships with other human beings. Nowhere do you see that more clearly than the war on gay men and women in this country being carried on by conservative Christians. If they would just back off and go back to the root of their faith, they would be the people out there fighting for gay rights.
How so? Make that case.
Because you're supposed to do to others as you would like to be done by. And if I was born gay, when people lied about me and said, it's your choice, you can change if you accept Jesus or undergo psychotherapy or whatever, that's a form of hatred.
Well, now you come up against dogma when you say this. You're asking somebody to be subjective about something they don't think is a subjective thing. If it's dogma, how do you change that? And then aren't you becoming the new atheists in trying to change someone
else? No, I don't think so, because I think that most evangelical American Protestants or right-wing Roman Catholics, whoever, think that somehow kindness, love, acceptance, tolerance, diversity are modern ideas associated with quote-unquote liberalism. What they don't understand is that those threads have been in our traditions from the beginning, and it just depends on what you pick and choose to concentrate on. And we all pick and choose. Otherwise, Southern Baptists would be stoning people who go to their marriage beds having lost their virginity because the Old Testament calls for it. So all I'm saying in the book is, let's admit we all pick and choose, and let's pick and choose the things that actually make our lives worth living.
Well, and you had a Hosanna moment about this, about what we pick. Your son was a Marine. You and he wrote a book called Keeping Faith. The military liked it and gave you access to boot camp at Parris Island, where you had a thought that the Christian right makes the mistake of thinking that basic religious training, say Bible study, is the end game instead of the starting point, like boot camp. And you say it's that kind of thinking that leads to extremist Christians showing up at funerals for dead soldiers, yelling, "God hates fags." This is a group from Kansas that does this because they believe that when U.S. soldiers die, it's because U.S. laws support gay rights. But you say it's because of the way they view their religion. Explain more your analogy between boot camp and fundamentalists.
The problem of fundamentalists is that if you took their attitude to boot camp, they'd stay there forever. For instance, if they're learning to do port arms, which is holding a rifle nicely and snapping it to your chest when you're marching on a parade deck, that's not the stuff you actually take with you into combat. But that teaches you camaraderie, discipline, obedience, and so forth. The little rules of boot camp were never the point of boot camp. The point of boot camp was to make you into Marines so you could graduate. Fundamentalists read the Bible or the Quran or these other books, and they read the rules and regulations, and they think the point was keeping the rule and regulation. The point wasn't that. The point was how you treat other people. The rules and regulations are simply a matter of discipline to get there.
You give examples from your mom and your Aunt Janet.
I talk about my Aunt Janet, who went into a group called the Exclusive Closed Brethren, which were so closed and exclusive that you couldn't even talk to your own family members unless they joined with you. And I was saying that I think it really changed the way my mom looked at things and opened up her view a little bit, because she realized her sister, in excluding her, was really doing the same thing to our family that we were doing to the rest of the world by saying, well, Jews aren't saved, Roman Catholics have got it wrong, these guys are wrong, atheists are going to hell. The fact is, it's just a question of how tightly you draw the circle. And when you see it very tightly drawn, then you realize the absurdity. And what I really am pushing for is that instead of seesawing between absolutes on one side or the other, let's just admit it. We can't explain this mystery and rather embrace it.
Or as you say, join the Church of Hopeful Uncertainty.
Right.
But how do you live with that paradox? Towards the end, you write, some days I know that life has no ultimate meaning. Other days I know every breath I take has eternal meaning. You live with both.
I do, because we're all different people at different times. Look, I've been married for close to 40 years. Some days being married means I'm fighting with my wife. Other days means that I love her. It was like the first day we met. It's all points in between. There are days I'm an atheist. There are days I'm the Christian my mother raised me to be, with knee-jerk fundamentalist gut reactions that make me ashamed. There are days when I realize I don't know anything. And aren't we all a little bit that way? So why do we approach faith in these terms of absolute certainties when we can't even decide where to go shopping with absolute certainty? The only thing I ever know anything about is small household appliances, because I can go online and figure it all out.
It's funny you mentioned small household appliances, because I love how you compare having faith to discovering electricity.
Exactly. And I think we keep talking about, well, is religion a man-made thing? Well, that's like saying, did we invent electricity? Of course we didn't.
It was there.
Yeah. Somebody came along and discovered how to use this. And I think religion's the same thing. Of course it's evolving. Of course it's man-made. Who else would be making it? But that doesn't mean that what we're gradually discovering as spiritual and good is not true. Look at the curve of history. 500 years ago, most Christians thought it would be okay to burn a Jew. Martin Luther was preaching that. Look at us now. We've learned something. We're not quite there. And so I think that we can discover our spiritual nature alongside the kind of quest that we're after in things like science. And these two things do not have to be mutually exclusive.
Frank Schaefer, author of Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism. Frank Schaefer, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, a soldier's wife blogs about the stress military life has put on her marriage and her children. That's tomorrow. Later today, what will the military trial for the Fort Hood shooter entail? But the latest news is next, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Spain, the mayor of Barcelona is getting some interesting Christmas cards. Instead of traditional holiday pictures, they feature graphic photos from the Spanish city's red light district, taken by residents fed up with conditions in the part of the city called Raval. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford reports.
At the back of their family shoe shop in central Barcelona, Luis and Alexia are sorting through their Christmas cards. But they're not sending pictures of Santa or snowmen this year. The images on these cards are distinctly unfestive.
Here there are some people using the street as a toilet.
And this one's the real special card.
This is the most famous photos. Making sex in the street.
The photo of a prostitute and her client, mid-act and mid-street, is one of many snapshots of life here in Raval, caught on camera by the residents. Luis tells me they're sending them to the local authorities for Christmas.
We're sending them to the mayor so he can hang the pictures by his Christmas tree. That way his family can see what's happening here, like my family has to. He always sends us cards with pretty pictures of Barcelona. But things happen here that aren't nearly so pretty.
Well, I will try to make you a bit sightseeing around the area.
Oscar Urdech decides I need to see a bit of life in Raval for myself.
And in the street we are walking, it's here is easy, you can buy some drugs.
He says a surge in sex workers has brought other problems to the district. There's a big needle exchange center for the many drug addicts now. But Oscar says they often inject on his doorstep.
You can see this is blood.
The situation's got so grim in recent years. This mum tells me even the children at a nearby playground are affected.
She says that she comes here first. She collects everything herself, cleans up condoms, syringes, everything. She just takes away so the children can play here safely. She said that you can clearly see here in the sign safe for small children from 1 year olds onwards. And they come here and if they see a condom or something on the ground, they'll pick it up and they'll eat it.
So the Christmas cards, winging their way to local officials, feature drug pushers and injecting addicts as well as prostitutes. Raval has been a red light district for years, but the locals say most of the sex workers these days are foreign. They believe some are forced to have sex in the streets to earn fast cash for the men who brought them to Spain and now control them. So just a couple of blocks from Barcelona's best art galleries and from the main tourist drag of Las Ramblas, I ask Oscar if paid sex in public is normal here now.
Normal, in terms of normality, not, but that it happens, yes. In Barcelona, we are receiving some tourism from UK mainly, that they are coming for celebrations, for a weekend, and they don't care about anything. And probably it's the people looking for the prostitutes on the Ramblas and finishing on any corner having sex. It's not that usual that everybody is getting sex on the streets.
But it happens.
It happens. Yeah.
The police are around, but you can't go to prison for fornicating in public in Spain. And Officer Agustin says there's not a lot he can do to stop it.
There's a problem that the neighbours, they sometimes they mistake the work of the police and the work of government.
But what can you do? If we're now on the
I can find them, or just I can say, put your dress on and go away.
perquè tenim previst amb 60 persones, però...
That's clearly not good enough for these residents, who want their special Christmas delivery to jolt the Barcelona authorities into action.
When you send these postcards to the mayor, to the police, what do you want them to do?
A little guilty. They have to know that they don't do the work they have to do.
Do you think they may be shocked when they see these pictures?
I hope so.
The city mayor didn't want to talk to us, but if a card from Raval does end up nestling on his mantelpiece amongst the tinsel, the candles and the Christmas lights, then these images of prostitutes, guns and drug pushers will be pretty difficult to ignore.
That report from the BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Barcelona. Well, up next, the military prepares its case against the alleged shooter at Fort Hood. There are big differences between military and civilian trials, as we'll hear in about 30 seconds here and now. Welcome back. The clock is ticking down to the trial of Major Nidal Hassan, the alleged Fort Hood shooter. Major Hassan is charged with 13 counts of premeditated murder in the deaths of a dozen soldiers and one civilian, and charged with attempting to murder 30 soldiers and two civilian police officers during that November 5th shooting rampage. He remains in Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas, paralyzed from the chest down. Eugene Fidel is president of the National Institute of Military Justice and a professor of military law at Yale University, where he joins us from the school's media center to bring us up to date on the proceedings. And Eugene, we understand that the first step the Army needs to take here is an inquiry into Major Hassan's mental state, his competency to stand trial. We know that Major Hassan had a number of problems during his psychiatric training. Some colleagues question his mental stability. So have you heard anything so far to lead you to believe that Major Hassan is mentally unfit to be tried?
At this point, I haven't heard anything about his prior activities or statements that cast a serious cloud over his competence for purposes of standing trial or sanity at the time of the alleged offenses. Now, that's not to say that something might not emerge, but you don't see here a pattern of mental illness, at least according to the information that has become available.
What is the intent of the court-martial? We understand trials only focus on what a suspect did or did not do. It's sort of like a classic dragnet approach, just the facts. Tell us a little bit about how the prosecution might be getting ready for trial and what it is that they have to prove.
Prosecutions in a court-martial today are really a close approximation of what you would expect in any American criminal court. That's not to say that there aren't some differences, and some of the differences are noteworthy. To give one example, the judges in courts-martial do not have the kind of long tenure that federal judges do in the district courts. The federal judges, of course, serve for life. In a court-martial, there's no requirement for any term of office at all, although the Army, to its credit, has instituted three-year terms of office. Well, 3 years is a very short term for a felony-level judge, so that's a substantial difference. Another substantial difference has to do with the selection of a jury. And the difference is, even though a jury in a capital case in the military has to have 12 people, they're not 12 people drawn at random from the voter registration rolls or the tax rolls. There are 12 people selected by the commander who convenes the court-martial.
Well, isn't that going to be an area ripe for debate? Because this is a military trial of someone accused of killing military members, and you'll have a military official choosing the jury.
Is it going to be a problem to make sure that people's opinions haven't already formed based on news reports? Absolutely. This is, by any standard, a very grave situation. And it is going to be the first order of business for the presiding military judge to make sure that the jury that is finally seated is a jury that is in a position to render impartial justice.
Do you think it's possible to get justice at Fort Hood? Do you think that there will have to be a change of venue, as I believe Hassan's lawyer has requested?
If I were the military judge or if I were the convening authority, the commanding general, I would find some way to transfer it to a different venue. Now, of course, it would be hard to find an installation where literally no one had heard about this. That would be preposterous. And yet, one would, just as a matter of wisdom in setting the wheels of justice in motion here, make every effort to find the least bad place to convene such a court-martial. Mm-hmm. And I think that's got to be someplace other than Fort Hood.
Well, staying with the jury for a second, we understand jurors have to be of a higher rank than the accused, and that, unlike in a civilian court, they can ask questions?
Military juries, they're called the members of the court-martial, not uncommonly will ask questions. The questions are submitted in writing to the judge. The lawyers are afforded an opportunity to review them before they're put to the witnesses. I recently defended a court-martial, and the members there had scores and scores of questions. It was quite extraordinary. Too many, I thought. I thought they had exceeded the limits of propriety, but it certainly is provided for under the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Yeah. Well, we understand once the court-martial gets underway, there's a finding phase, the prosecution trying to prove his guilt with their evidence. They call witnesses. Hassan's lawyers cross-examine, challenge evidence, as you said, just like a civilian court. But when it comes to coming to a conclusion, how many members of the jury do you need to convict in a court-martial?
A capital case, you need 12 members on the court-martial. That's a relatively recent innovation, by the way. And in such a case, they have to be unanimous.
And you would need a unanimous vote to pass a death penalty, which the military is expected to ask for?
You would need a unanimous vote both as to the question of guilt or innocence, and then if the individual is found guilty, to impose a death sentence. The important thing to recognize is that the military justice system makes no provision for hung juries. You don't dismiss the jury if they can't agree. If they can't agree, then you don't have unanimity and you don't get the death sentence.
But if convicted and unanimously sentenced to death, Major Hassan would have a long avenue of appeals under the military justice system that could take his case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And if the conviction and death sentence is upheld, you know, by all the courts, remind us, when was the last time a soldier sentenced to death was executed?
The last time it happened was in 1961. That was a case of Private John Bennett. Private Bennett was convicted of having raped and attempted to murder an Austrian schoolgirl during the post-World War II occupation. President Eisenhower approved the death sentence, and the process took so long that by the time President Kennedy was inaugurated in 1961, Bennett was still around. And so Bennett applied to President Kennedy for clemency, and there was a quite moving plea that he made. President Kennedy had the matter examined and in the end decided to let the execution proceed. Now, let me mention that uniquely under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, you cannot have an execution actually carried out unless the President of the United States affirmatively approves it. That's not clemency. This is simply in order to get there, you need affirmative approval of the President. And frankly, I think presidents since the Kennedy administration have not been in a hurry to approve death sentences. Typically, these cases sort of linger within the executive branch and may be left in the inbox for the incoming president at noon on Inauguration Day.
That's Eugene Fidel, president of the National Institute of Military Justice, also professor of military law at Yale University, giving us an overview of courts martial, but also the one that may be in the future of Major Nidal Hassan. Professor Fidel, thanks so much.
It's my privilege.
And then a final note here. Since 1984, there have been 15 death sentences handed down by military courts. 10 were commuted or overturned. The rest are on appeal. According to the Pentagon, there are currently 4 soldiers on death row in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. We'll be back in 1 minute, Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. If you're still looking for a holiday gift for the aspiring chef on your list, you're in luck. Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst, says there's a cornucopia of cookbooks to choose from. She joins us in the studio with some of her favorites, and they are big. Lots of text and beautiful pictures.
Well, the trend this year goes exactly against what you might think. This being a year of recessionary times, of people cutting back, the books are bigger and fatter than ever. They average at about $30, but they're spectacular. They're very chef and restaurant driven. I don't choose books from TV Food Network stars because those just sell a million copies simply because of their shows. These are chefs that are actually writing books and telling stories, a lot of childhood tales, which when they're interesting are great, and when they're not are a little tedious. But these are books chock full of stupendous recipes. I cooked from every single one of these books.
Because you are you, so you cook from them, but others can read them. And I also want to mention that we'll get to the chef's books, but also friend to chefs. Let's start with Ruth Reichel. She has come out with Gourmet Today. She's, of course, the former engine behind Gourmet Magazine, which was closed by its parent, Condé Nast. Saddened so many people. Were you one of them? And does this book sort of... is this the exclamation point on the end of that life?
I was really saddened by it. I mean, Gourmet has been publishing for 70 years. I grew up with it. It was a magazine that a lot of people dreamed by, mm-hmm. but they also cooked by it, and it was solid. If you cooked a recipe from Gourmet, it worked. So now we have this gigantic 1,000-recipe mm-hmm. book called Gourmet Today. The saddest thing in the whole world is this little sticker on the cover of the book that says, a subscription to Gourmet Magazine is included in the price of this book. And there's a little section on the inside flap that you cut out and send in for your magazine. Mm. Well, clearly that doesn't exist. It's a huge loss for the food world. Does this book make up for it? Well, there's no photography, but it's chock full of how we're cooking now. It uses all kinds of flavors like lemongrass and ginger. Most interesting to me is they have a chapter called Vegetarian Main Courses. This would never have existed in a Gourmet Magazine cookbook, even 5 years ago. I mean, things as plebeian as tempeh burgers and tofu salad sandwiches. But then if you're a meat eater, there's just spectacular lamb biryani and bok choy gratin. This is kind of the joy of cooking for now. It's a great book if you want only one book for someone, whether they're starting out or they've been cooking for years.
Okay, that's Gourmet Today. More than 1,000 all-new recipes for the contemporary kitchen, edited by Ruth Reichel. We'll have all Kathy's suggestions at our website, herenow.org. Another book that has the feeling of a tribute is your second pick, John Besh's My New Orleans, The Cookbook.
John Besh's book, My New Orleans, is also quite thick, but spectacular. There's photographs of every festival that New Orleans gives, and I think this might be the most interesting book of the year. There's a chapter on Mardi Gras. There's one on Southern Christmas. There's tons about seafood in here. Trout and redfish have their own chapter. There's creole, crawfish, shrimp season.
Okay.
Yeah, you get hungry. But guess what? My favorite recipe in the book, oddly enough, is for a salad. I'm opening a tin for you.
You know, I've been trying to figure out what that is.
This is called pumpkin seed brittle. I'm sliding it over to you. This you scatter over salad. I had this at the end of our Thanksgiving feast. It's a tiny bit spicy. It's so simple. It's sugar, raw pumpkin seeds called pepitas, salt, cayenne pepper, and then you whisk an egg white, not till stiff but soft. You spread it on a cookie sheet, you bake it for 20 minutes, you let it cool, and you have this crunchy, delicious, slightly spicy brittle for salads at the holiday time, for a gift giving. Completely addicted to it.
Oh my goodness. I was about to say, what's this? No big deal. It's like peanut brittle. And then that kicked in. What is that?
That's the
burning.
Cayenne. But it's sweet and spicy, so it's so interesting in your mouth. And if you try that on local greens with a little bit of blue cheese, it will be one of the salads of your life.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Well, you may hear some crunching through the rest of this. So I adore this book.
It's great. Okay. A couple of cookbooks give us tastes of two ethnic cuisines.
Mama Fuku. David Chang is a young Korean chef. He now owns 4 restaurants in New York. They don't take reservations. People stand online in the freezing cold to get in there. He's like the pork god. What this guy can do to pork belly is so unbelievable. He has these pork buns in his restaurant that I dream about not being a vegetarian. And the recipe was in the book. So when I saw the book, I naturally assumed this is just going to be another chefy kind of book. He's going to give you the recipe, but it won't work at home. So I actually went out and bought a pork belly. And it was so fabulous. It was so simple. I marinated it in salt and sugar overnight. I roasted it very slowly. I was like, wow, I don't have to crave this anymore. I can make it. He also has really spectacular adaptations of interesting Asian-style vegetarian dishes. There's a kimchi stew. There's a wonderful buttermilk salad dressing. He tells you how to make ramen from start to finish. This is really sophisticated food, but not necessarily complicated. The recipes I tried, no problem. I have to add one thing. Mm. It's X-rated. You have never read a cookbook with the F word scattered so liberally throughout. He talks about, oh, I made this, but I didn't want to F up, and I would never have added the sugar because I thought it was too effing.
Okay.
You got it?
Okay.
But that's an interesting twist in a cookbook for someone that's read a million cookbooks.
Oh, be aware, it's not something you want to give.
Not
you
for the children.
Or to your mom. Okay, maybe. Okay, on to How to Roast a Lamb.
By Michael Salakis, a wonderful Greek chef who owns restaurants in New York City. He tells great childhood stories about fishing with his dad in Long Island and about growing up. And all these chefs share this love of food that started at a very early age as something that, in a world that they found confusing, was something they could hold on to. This food is gorgeous. I made a white bean soup. No chicken broth, no meat. It's water-based. You simmer these white beans till they become buttery, and you puree them with a little bit of celery. Mm. It's this exquisite soup, and you sprinkle fresh dill and feta cheese, two very Greek flavors.
And then you throw in a piece of cayenne pepper peanut brittle. Oh, no, wait, sorry.
You can throw that on virtually anything.
I'm still eating that. So How to Roast a Lamb goes on the list as well. I'm so glad that you brought this next book because I just think it's one of the most beautiful, and it comes from a chef who has such a lovely backstory. Barbara Lynch's Stir. She's from here in the South Boston, a neighborhood in the Boston area. Had a kind of a hard scrabble coming up, and now she's just at the top of her game.
And she also tells her story of growing up in Southie, as it's called, in a real working-class family. And her ticket out was food. She now owns Number 9 Park, one of the most highly esteemed restaurants in New England. And this book also brings it down to the home level. There's roasted eggplant with golden raisin, pine nut vinaigrette, and feta. Mm. She teaches you how to make homemade ricotta, which, by the way, is two steps. Anyone can do it. There's rigatoni with spicy sausage and cannellini beans. Spectacular photographs. And she has these really wonderful boxes scattered throughout the text, giving you tips on things, showing you how it should be, kind of holding your hand and saying, it's not enough just to make the recipe. Let me show you what the texture should be. She's kind of there with you.
Great. Barbara Lynch's Stir. And we just want to mention a couple of books. We've had the authors on the show, and we can link you up to the conversations with them. One is Brian Terry's Vegan Soul Kitchen, Fresh, Healthy, and Creative African-American Cuisine. Terrific. And one is from Judith Jones, as you know, former editor of Julia Child, The Pleasures of Cooking for One. You can hear our conversations with the authors and get Kathy Gunst's list at our website, hearnow.org, where you can also see Kathy making a recipe from one of her new books, Stonewall Kitchen Breakfast, which we highly recommend as well.
Oh, thanks.
Kathy, thanks, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, and eat well.